All right, guys, welcome in to another episode of the SEC Basketball Experience here at Southeastern 14 / soon to be Southeastern 16 by the time the next episode drops. So be sure to, if you're searching for us, search for both Southeastern 14 and 16. You'll find us one of the two. But as always, Max Barr joins, and we're going to jump into this episode. Got a lot of fun things to talk about. Going to welcome on Neil Blackman from the Florida Basketball Hour to discuss where things stand with the Gators in this offseason, and we have some home court advantages via Max Barr here. We're going to rank the top 10 home courts in SEC basketball, sure to not spark any sort of discussion whatsoever with that. But before we jump in, our friends at Bet Online, your number one source for all your sports betting needs this season. They've got baseball, golf, soccer, all the top fights, UFC, MMA, and boxing, plus every stat matchup and even live odds and spreads. While the games are being played, when the game's over, head on over to the online casino, get on a game of blackjack or poker. Plus, you can unwind when one of over 150 slots games. Head to the website today, get on the action, use that promo code BLEAV, B-L-E-A-V, for 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online, the game starts here. All right, Max, let's jump right in. Your top 10 home court advantages in SEC basketball. You put out a tweet here recently, and you listed kind of records as of the past couple years for home court. But I assume this will tie in a little bit more than just that. But let's get it started. We're going to count these down at number 10. I'll give you my reaction and tell you why you're wrong at every spot. But
great. That's exactly what I'm – that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted.
Of course.
So I made this fun. I dove in a little bit, looked at records over the past 2 years because it's hard to take in all the history into account. I wanted to keep it modern, took in a little bit of momentum into consideration, what's been happening in the offseason, and also capacity. You know, how many are we going for that small high school gym feel, or are we trying to blow the roof off this place with 20,000? So took everything into consideration. Also asked a few of the SEC basketball Twitter panel. I reached out to, you know, the JC Hoops, the Brandy, the Nate Oates Burner. Don't worry, I got a bunch of opinions here. Starting off at number 10 here now, Blake. Now, this is going to a team that had a fantastic home court last year, really upped the ante from the year before. That's South Carolina at Colonial Life Arena. That place was bumping, single-handedly won them a few of those close home games where Talon, Mr. Big Shot Cooper, would hit a three and the place would just go nuts. Few huge home court wins there for South Carolina. Blake, any pushback on having South Carolina in my top 10?
Well, see, the only problem is like I won't have any pushback until your list is finished because
okay,
I won't know who's been left out.
Okay.
So like at this kind of spot, like I'll give you some pushback as we get closer to the top tier. But like now I'm like, well, there's South Carolina, but who's not going to be on this list here? Let's find out. Let's go to number 9.
Number 9, we have the Aggies of Texas A&M. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Reed Arena, when you look at Texas A&M over the past 2 years, man, they've been pretty good. They were 15-1 2 years ago on that great run where they just were unbeatable down the stretch. And then 10-5 last year. So they've got a two-year record here, 25-6. That's pretty dang good. That's top five in the SEC. With that style of play, Blake, with that rough, they don't really shoot all that well. When they do make a few threes at home and that crowd starts going, it just adds up. So I got A&M coming in at number 9.
All right. I'm okay with that for now.
Okay. Number 8, we have the Humphrey Coliseum, Mississippi State. Now this one, I had to do a little bit of digging into, because they have a bit of an iffy record. They were 11-4 at home this past year, 12-4 2 years ago. But the reason that I stuck Mississippi State up on here is because of the wins that they did get in the past few years. I mean, we're talking some of their biggest wins of their whole season. It was at home. Last year, they had the huge Auburn win. They had the huge Tennessee win. They came a possession away from beating Alabama at home. There was a multiple big-time games at the Hump last year that crowd just carried them. So we've got the Hump coming in at number 8.
Interesting.
Moving up, number 7, Florida. They were unbelievable at home this last year, much better than I thought. They only dropped one game, Blake. They only dropped one. They were 14-1 this past year. It was a big jump from the year before, and that's where I'm kind of pulling into this momentum. I think Todd Golden's kind of got things rolling. That crowd has brought, you know, back into things. You got Walter Clayton coming back. There's a lot of buzz, a lot of excitement. I've got Florida coming off of a one-loss home trip last year, or one-loss home stint last year. Got them coming in here in the top 10, Blake.
I like it. I think the momentum is back in the O'Connell Center. What is it? The Exact Tech Arena now.
So, Exact yeah. Tech.
Yeah.
I don't know how to say it. Yeah. So we got Florida at number 7. Moving up to number 6, we have a newcomer, the Texas Longhorns, the Moody Center. The Moody Center has been a fortress, not going to lie, over the past 2 years. Blake, they have the most home wins out of everybody in the SEC now and at home over the past 2 years. They're 31-5 in the Moody Center over the past 2 years. I mean, that's up there. It was actually, shout out to Ole Miss, who just missed out on the top 10. It was Chris Beard who really revived that fan base. If you watch the Texas crowd 2 years ago with the Marcus Carr, the Timmy Allen team, they have these like long, it looks like the noodles that you have in the pool, and they're orange and white, and everyone's just moving them back and forth. It looks crazy in the crowd. They have a good atmosphere there at the Moody Center. So got them at number 6, I believe. Yes, number 6. Now we're heading into the top 5, Blake.
This is where we go. Now I can start pushing back a lot. All right.
Yeah. Here we go. Oh God, I'm just gonna get shredded. Here we go.
Why did you suggest this topic? Remember, you suggested this topic, not me. So.
Hey. Someone's got to do it.
Are you going where I think you're going for number 5? Let me find out.
I don't know. Number 5, I've got Bud Walton.
Oh.
Okay. And if we did this last year in the offseason, I would have had them a few spots higher. But it lost a little bit of its fortress last year. There was a few early exits by the fans. Didn't have that untouchable feel that it had from the few years before that. In the past 2 years at home, Arkansas is actually 8th in the SEC. They're 26-9 over the past 2 years. So I would have thought that they were a little bit better record-wise, but there were a few cracks in the armor. But that momentum of Cal coming back, I think there's a lot of excitement now. I couldn't leave them out of the top 5.
If you're doing this after this upcoming season, I think it's highly unlikely they're at number 5. I think they're higher. But as you said, if you're ranking teams in the top, we can say last year was an outlier, but you also can't ignore the fact that they didn't just lose some home games last year. They got obliterated in some home games last year. They lost by 32 at home to Auburn. They lost by 13 at home to South Carolina. They lost by 29 at home to Tennessee. And so, yes, they also lost at home to Vanderbilt. And so I think, that I can, even if there will be some pushback, and I think historically, if you're doing this for the past 40 years or whatever, it would be different. But for now, I would agree with you. I think Cal will bring that back. But if you're just doing a ranking before this season, you can't ignore how bad it got last year and some of those games on their home floor. So
yeah, that's all it was. Some cracks in the armor, but I'm very confident that place will be buzzing once again. So moving up, number 4, I have Tennessee. I've got Tennessee, biggest arena in the SEC, just under 22,000. That is nuts. I didn't know it was that much. But 14-2 the past 2 years, consistent 14-2, 14-2. That is rock solid. I was calling Thompson Bowling or the Food City, whatever you want to call it. I was calling it the Fortress for a while last year. I don't know if you remember that, but I was calling it the Fortress because they just seemed untouchable. Consistent. That's what they've been here at home, Blake.
I think I would put Tennessee higher, but
okay.
I know who you're going to have at number 3 because I know who's going to be at 2-1. Yeah. So
you would have
based on the past couple years, I think I could put Tennessee ahead of the next team that you're going to have is my guess. Now, you may have another team up next, but I think I know the team you're going to have. But I think, man, Tennessee has pretty much been – remember, one of those losses the past couple years was at the buzzer to Missouri. what, I mean, they went unbeaten at home the year before that. And so, yeah, they have a 7-point loss to Kentucky, buzzer beater loss to Missouri, a 4-point loss to South Carolina, and then the 4-point loss to Kentucky. And again, they went unbeaten in 22. So I could make the argument that Tennessee should be higher here. But I like continue on the list.
I like that. And I'll be interested to see if you what your thoughts are on this. So at number three, I have Kentucky. And the reason that I have Kentucky is the momentum. That was like my big momentum thing. I think that fan base just is rallying behind Mark Pope, that the you know, opening ceremony, whatever you want to call that, when he came out with the trophy and the team and everything. I just feel like that fan base is just rejuiced. And with all the history and everything. So that's why I had Kentucky above. But now when I think about it, in hindsight, I might have wanted to switch those two. But, yeah.
Historically, Rupp, obviously, would be in the argument for the top spot. There's no question about it. Let's not kid ourselves here. But if you just go by the numbers.
The numbers aren't that great.
They have lost 8 games at home in the past 2 seasons. Man. And so I can understand why, you know, again, and this is where I think there will be the Tennessee versus Kentucky argument. Like I said, I could certainly make a very strong argument that Tennessee should be ahead of Kentucky as it stands right now. But if you are tying into momentum and all that, like, yes, Rupp will be rocking. Will they lose 4 games at home this upcoming season? I don't think so. I think that is unlikely because it does feel like kind of a rejuvenated program. But like we said, they lost 4 at home last year. One of those was to UNC Wilmington. You know, lost 4 at home the year before. One of those was to a bad South Carolina team. You know, that was the South Carolina team finished, 11-21. And so that was, kind of one of those weird home losses. But Kentucky fans can also say, hey, Cal is at Arkansas now. We're not going to let that happen. Mark Pope's not going to let that happen. And so, again, that's where, like, the time frame of your list is important, because if it is recent history versus the historical, then I think you could make the argument that Tennessee should be higher than Kentucky. But if you're tying in the momentum, I can understand why Rupp, always a fortress for many, 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 many years, could be in this spot. So
it's kind of like the argument of like the consistency of Tennessee and just the fortress that's been arguing against, like, the history and momentum of the Kentucky program right now. I could see it. I can see it either way. It's real
and I
close.
Think it's also who you lose to. And I mean, like, if you're doing the home court advantage, right? I think that has to matter. And again, Kentucky just had some very head scratching losses at home in recent years. And look, we know that's kind of led to this change in the program. And so I think ultimately, as I mentioned earlier with Arkansas, I think if we're doing this list a year from now, I think Kentucky and Arkansas will be moving up. But to move up, you've got to have teams in front of you lose games at home. And right now, there are certain teams like Tennessee and the next couple that I know are going to be the top two that are not really losing games at home. So,
yeah. So we're down to the top two here. And it's
you want to talk about an argument. Here we go. Like, you are in a no-win situation here.
No.
Because these two, your decision on who should be one and who should be two, you cannot get out of this without just infuriated fan base on the other side.
Either way, just let me start with these teams are 1-2, okay? So they're 1-2, all right? You can argue it any other way. I'll tell you how I separated them. So at number two, I've got Alabama. And the reason that I have Alabama at number two, well, they have the best home record in the conference. I didn't look at the country, but it's got to be up there over the past 2 years. They're 29-2 in Coleman over the past 2 years. And they're the only SEC team in the past 2 years to have that undefeated season. I think you mentioned Tennessee had done it. Or was that just at home? I think. Yeah, just at home. But undefeated SEC home season, Alabama, only team in the past 2 years. Only 2 losses is ridiculous. I don't know how they have not at least just had an off shooting night more than a few nights. But also it's that So obviously we know who number one is, right? Auburn. The reason that I went with Auburn at number one compared to Alabama, I mean, you're splitting hairs. Alabama 29-2 over the past 2 years, Auburn 29-3. Well, big difference there, right? But kind of that small gym atmosphere of Neville, how it you can almost have, you have to turn down the volume at home on the TV, how loud that place gets sometimes. The students camping out like a full, I don't know how many hours, days before games. I feel like that kind of high school gym, not high school gym, I mean, there's still almost 10,000 people in there, but that kind of compact atmosphere, that rocking house, there's not a seat open, you can't even breathe, you're right on the players. That's why I have that atmosphere of Auburn just above Alabama, even though Alabama's got the best record.
All right, so I know I probably shouldn't get in on this debate, but I will say that
you're in.
Support your pick for number one here, I will say that if you go back to when Auburn turned things around under Bruce Pearl, which they officially kind of jumped into the national conversation, say with 2018, they went 26-8, and so that would be seven seasons. So the past seven seasons, I think they've only lost 12 home games in seven seasons. So you can do the math and see how that's, you know, that's, it's not bad, right? That's less than two home games per year that they've lost just in 7 years. So yeah. I think that's pretty impressive. And like we said, if we went to the longer term for every other team in this, you could probably argue that some teams beat. But it is kind of to prove the point that the consistency has been there. Like there have not really been those ups and downs. Now, yes, it does happen when you have a 13-14 season like they did in 2021. But like the program itself has been a model of consistency outside of just that 1 year, really since 2018. So I think, you know, we understand, like, welcome to the jungle, all this other stuff. And so I can see that. But again, Alabama fans, they're not too upset either when it comes to where they're at, because like you mentioned, they are just, you know, it's the success they're having as a program. It's obviously equating into more wins. They were a number one overall seed a couple of years ago. You know, they were a Final Four team this year, even though they did lose some home games, you know, and lost a couple. But I think, yeah, like that is something too, where you look at it. And I guess if you want to play like the game of, okay, which of these teams has beaten the other team at home? Right? Like if you want to play that game, like that is one where I think it was Auburn did beat Alabama at home in 2022. So if you want to, so Auburn won in Tuscaloosa in 2022. So if you want to play that game, I guess you can go with that, but that's not exactly the best formula maybe to decide that. But
the thing about, just to wrap this up real quick, one last thought on Alabama, where, you know, with Auburn, how we have the, you know, the welcome to the jungle, like the students propping tents days before, the crazy atmosphere. Alabama, like as a team, remember back in the season when we were talking about the shooting splits from when Alabama plays at home and from away? Like they just love playing in that gym. They were shooting like, I don't know, damn near 50% from three as a team for most of the season at home. So, you know, take that into consideration too. They just torch the Nets at home.
Well, one of the teams we mentioned about having, well, actually, hold on a second. So the teams that got left out quickly.
Oh, yes.
So that would be, let's see.
It was
Ole Miss, Georgia, Ole Miss, Vanderbilt, LSU, Oklahoma. Is there somebody else? Missouri.
Yeah.
All right. If Missouri could have kept the momentum going from year one, they would be on the list probably. But I know that did not happen, so you can't go with that. So, boy, Vanderbilt fans are thinking, if you did this list a decade ago and any year, like, and did not have Vanderbilt on this list in the top 10, you'd have been like, what world are you living in? You're living in an alternate universe. But no longer the case. We'll see if Mark Byington can bring that back. So, All right. We are going to talk to Neil Blackman from the Florida Basketball Hour about the Gators and some other, you know, his thoughts on some SEC basketball topics as well. So Neil does a great job over there, him and Eric Fawcett. If you're a Florida fan, you already know about those guys. If you're a fan who just wants to learn more about the league and, you know, the Gators, if you're preparing for them as an opponent, whatever, like, it's an unbelievable resource. So let's jump into our conversation with Neil Blackman. All right, guys, we welcome on Neil Blackman from the Florida Basketball Hour. You guys know we've talked about them before here on numerous videos, talking about the Gators and being sure to follow their coverage of this Florida basketball team throughout the season and in the offseason. Because, Neil, it's always good to talk to you. And I know coming off of last season, feels like there is, you know, finally, I guess you could say, like, it feels like there is kind of that renewed momentum with the program. And I know, again, there, as always, are ups and downs throughout the season. And but, man, it feels like that Florida's in a pretty good spot here heading into to year three of the Todd Golden era.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I mean, there's juice around the program for the first time in a while. I mean, let's be honest. I think probably since they landed Kerry Blackshear and were preseason top five, this is the most that anybody in the national conversation has mentioned them. I'm sure Florida fans want to quickly forget about how that year went, although there was no NCAA tournament, so they didn't even get a chance to vindicate what actually went down that year. But a lot of juice. Look, I think Florida returns of the players returning in the SEC, the argument can be made that Florida returns either the second or third best player coming back with Walter Clayton Jr. Returning. They certainly have a chance to have in a league loaded with great backcourts, they have a chance to have one of the best backcourts. I think that's a good chance at just how good, I think, really is the question. And then Todd Golden has proven to be adept at how he uses the transfer portal. I don't know if you can hit I think hitting better than Florida did last year with Zion Poulin, Tyrese Samuel, and Walter Clayton Jr. is out of the question. That's not going to happen. But I think that the most underrated transfer that anyone landed in the SEC, and this is the one hot take that I will bring to your show today, is Elijah Martin. Guy's been runner-up for Conference Player of the Year in two leagues. And it just seems mysterious to me that there was less you'll see top 10 transfers in the SEC, and Elijah Martin is off some of them. That's absurd. He was a defensive anchor on a team that went to the Final Four. All defensive team player in two leagues. Like I said, Conference Player of the Year, runner up in two leagues, a winner. And I think a guy who can find joy playing basketball again. Talking to Elijah a little bit. I think one of the things that kind of gets lost is all the pressure that all those FAU kids felt last year, being kind of this mid-major darling that went to the Final Four and then everybody returned. So everybody expected it to just be easy. We know it wasn't. They beat some great teams, right? They won some really fun games, but obviously lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament. There was a ton of pressure. Dusty May now leaves, and now I think all those guys have an opportunity, including Johnny Davis, who's in the SEC, have a chance to kind of find their joy again and be great. So a different role for Elijah, and that's, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about what Florida's biggest question is. But yeah, with Martin and Clayton, the makings of an exceptional backcourt. And some serious juice just in the recruiting trail as well. Not just that they land Alex Lloyd, the first, you know, in-state top 50 player since Trey Mann, but also that, you know, they're considered legitimate contenders for Tony Bryant, legitimate contenders for the Boozer twins. If they aren't one of the final three hats on the table for the Boozers, I'll eat this nice Pinehurst hat. So I think, yeah, juice and energy. It should be an exciting season in Gainesville.
Max, before you jump in, I got to say, Neil is making me very excited for my – remember, we do our bowl predictions on each show, Neil. At the end of the show, we always give one bowl prediction for the upcoming season, and we're going to do like a running tally of what we get right and what we get wrong. We know we're going to get a lot of those wrong. But my first one was, I said, I'm going with the FAU duo of Jonnell Davis – and Elijah Martin to be first team all SEC guys. I said that was my first choice. And now I'm just going to sit back and just assume that we are 100% getting that one right, because you just, you talked me into it. I'm even more into it now. So,
I'll stay on the Elijah Martin topic, because I had a kind of a question about him. So in that backcourt, maybe add in the wings also. We're going to have, you know, Walter and Will back, of course. And then we're both very excited for the leap that we think Denzel Aberdeen might take. But you kind of, I wouldn't want to say trade ZP for Elijah Martin, but you do have that Pullen is leaving and we're bringing in Elijah Martin. How would you think Martin's role is going to be different from what Pullen brought to the team? How is that going to be different? Because they're both fantastic players, but their games are different.
Yeah, they are different, and they are essentially being asked to replace one another from a chemistry standpoint, from a leadership standpoint, I think in particular. And then Elijah Martin is going to be the point guard. So let's just get that out there, because this is the Twitter beating I take in the DMs all the time at Florida Basketball Hours. There's still people in the portal. Are they going to go get their true point guard? Are they going to get one from your? No, they're not. Elijah Martin is going to handle 40 to 50% of the primary ball handling duties. Is that good? We don't know. Now, here's what we do know. According to Hooplins and according to Evan Maya, the data says that he can do it. He had an 11.1 turnover percentage. That's really low. That's very good. He had a 10.8 turnover percentage as a primary ball handler. So the smart question is, well, how often did Dusty Mason do that? The answer to that is not often, 1 in 5 possessions. So Florida's going to ask him to do that a lot more than 1 in 5 possessions, because in order for Walt Clayton to be, I think, the best player in the league other than Mark Sears, which is what I think he is, in order for that to happen, he cannot be the point guard. We saw Florida lose a couple games last year where Walt had the ball late and was asked to distribute. The Virginia game, Ryan Dunn. I mean, no shame in that, but Ryan Dunn forces a turnover.
Yep.
They lose. Late in the Alabama game in Tuscaloosa, a game Florida probably feels like they should have won. A couple different Walter Clayton turnovers late. Now, one of them was just a tremendous from-behind steal by Mark Sears, but – it's still Walter Clayton in a position to make a play late. Zion Pullen did not turn the ball over. We all know the story, led the Power Six in assist to turnover ratio. I think finished second in that category in turnover percentage. So what are they trading? They're trading the surety of the ball security for defense. Now, Mike White used to say playing fast is in his DNA. And with due respect to my boy Mike, that's just not true. We know that that's not accurate. From his late years in Florida, and we know it's not accurate from how they're playing at Georgia. That's fine. I mean, Mike is doing a good job in Athens, but I think defense is in Todd Golden's DNA. His San Francisco team's guarded at St. Mary's. If you don't guard, you don't play for Randy Bennett. nowadays you hit the portal real fast if you don't guard. Todd loved that they were an elite offense last year. He also lamented that their ceiling was limited because they did not guard well enough. They have gone and fixed that in the transfer portal. So the real questions now are, what do you get in that trade-off? Well, you have this question at point guard, which is going to linger over the whole team, I think, until early in the season. But they are going to defend better. Elijah Martin can defend anyone in this league. He's going to be one of the best on-ball defenders immediately in the SEC. And we saw it last year, right? Like whether it was shutting down Caleb Love in the win over Arizona, or whether it was being all regional in the NCAA tournament on the way to the Final Four when he guards everyone's best scorer. Y'all know, speaking of Johnny Davis, like how fun is Arkansas, Florida, John L. Davis on Elijah Martin going to be? Like, come on, that's going to be such fun TV. So they are trading those things off. And I think, in order for it to work, they need the jump from Zell Aberdeen that you guys alluded to. And then I think, then the question is Zay Brown. Like we saw, he's playing, the freshman that's coming in is playing for the Puerto Rican national team. The most impressive thing, and I actually saw Blake tweet about this early in the year, not to call it, let's praise the Blake Lavelle Twitter, can we? kind of praising Florida's freshman evaluations last year because they ended up being really good for a team that had, what, the 14th ranked recruiting class in the SEC. Well, Thomas Houck and Alex Condon were awesome.
Yeah.
And they love Zay Brown. They think that he is going to play 10 to 15 minutes for them. Mm-hmm. He's a guy who can beat you off the bounce, and he's a guy who really competes defensively. So I think the idea is we don't want to be a defense that's 85th, 84th in efficiency all year. We think we can be a top 40 defense. And if we give something away offensively, that's okay because we know what a Final Four profile, with all due respect to Alabama's bizarro profile, looks like. And you look at what Nate did in the portal, and he knows they got to guard better too.
Yep.
So the front court is interesting because, you know, we talked about Samuel and what he did last year, and obviously Han Logdon's injury. He won't play this season, but you did mention kind of the development of Condon and our guy, Tommy Houck, who we always just refer to him as Tommy Houck. That's our guy. but, you know, that they also made some significant additions as well. But when you look at the front court, we talked about, and certainly the backcourt is going to get the attention because, like you said, they could have the best player in the conference. If you put him behind Mark Sears, he's one of the top three players in the conference. We talked about Martin could be one of the top players in the conference, and then the excitement for the other guys. But as you look at how this front court could play out in terms of rotation and the development, as we said, of these younger guys now into their sophomore years, what excites you most about what we could see just from that group?
Well, the freshman analytic numbers compared to some elite players. Willie Cauley-Stein, from a shot blocking standpoint on Condon, finished top 150 in block percentage. A really elite guy at getting to the free throw line offensively already. So I think that will improve. I think the real question, I think that they expect, you know, you will hear, if you took a shot every time you heard Todd Golden's an analytics guy, you would not make it to the second half of most games. And I do not recommend that, just so our listeners are clear. But yeah, I mean, I think they expect Condon to fill the Samuel void from a production standpoint. Okay. So the question is, who produces at the Alex Condon level? And then maybe better than that, because the idea is to raise your ceiling. And I think that they feel like, I think they feel like they have upgraded massively on the defensive end with Sam Alexis from UT Chattanooga, who can really rebound and who can really guard. He can guard five spots, which is nice in the SEC, as we all know. And then Ruben Chinyelu is another guy who adds shot blocking. I'm not as high on Ruben as some of the Florida beat writers, I should say some of the other Florida beat writers because of my SDS work, but I am maybe higher on Sam Alexis than some people just because I think he has a wider range of skills. And we've all saw Todd is really good at getting his bigs that can handle a little bit away from the basket and putting, you know, bigger big men in bad positions to guard. That's the kind of stuff I think Alexis can feast on because he can handle it a little bit. You can get him out at the elbow and he can attack, which is another thing that Condon can do. I think as Alex improves as a shooter, you know, he's playing with Australia this summer and is 7 of 15 from the 3-point line in three games. Pretty good. And that's the international line. So it's clear what he's been working on. Nobody's going to play with his level of energy, as we saw in the NCAA tournament when he really played outstanding until fouling out. So that's kind of it. But does the front court being as productive as last year's rely heavily on Alex taking the jump they think he can take? Yes. Do they think that they are much, much better defensively in the front court as a staff? Yes, they absolutely think that because of Chinyelu and because of Alexis, even without Han Logdon, who I think they have wisely said that they expect a redshirt. They don't expect Oliver Ryu, the Goliath, to play any. He's certainly a developmental project. He should redshirt. But that's kind of where they're looking at the front court. And then I think they'll add a wing internationally here in the next couple of weeks, which would accompany Tommy Hawk and give them another guy that can give them some minutes on the wing. You know, Hauk is interesting because I feel like Tommy, he's certainly a mismatch that we saw in a couple SEC games late in the year. You don't really know how to guard that guy because he's so big and strong and he can handle a little bit. And then he started making the threes that always look so pretty and missed early in the season. And you're kind of like, how can a guy with a shot that nice miss? You know, so the jump he takes will be interesting in terms of how multiple Florida can be. Cause I do think last year when teams beat Florida, it was because like South Carolina, for example, it was just kind of like, we're going to take everything away but their guards and just see if their guards can win. And their guards are awesome, but sometimes that worked. Right. And I think we saw how awesome Florida's guards were in their wins over Alabama, where they were better than Alabama's guards were collectively. But, you know, there also was like, hey, if you make Tyrese Samuel hit shots and you make him and Condon beat you, maybe you can beat Florida. Okay. You know, or you take away the complementary pieces. And the second strategy worked better. I think people will not be able to do that as well this year if Alex Condon takes the jump that Florida expects.
Neil, you may have already answered my last question here throughout. I think I know what you'll say, but so when we look at Florida's close losses last year, a lot of those heartbreaking road losses, the one pointer to A&M, OT at Alabama, you just 6 points to South Carolina, 1 point to Vandy. I know that was kind of a weird spot there at the end of the season, but if Florida is going to win these games in this upcoming season, why are they all of a sudden winning these close games that they weren't able to close the deal on last year?
That's a great question. And that, look, that's the key to, like, for me, I don't know about you guys, but for me, like, the SEC, the tiers are Alabama. And then, like, I love the Auburn team. I think that they're almost in that tier, but they're not. Like, so for me, it's kind of like Alabama, Auburn, and then at the top of the third tier is like a group of four teams, and Florida's in there. And for Florida to move out of that tier from three to six and compete in one and two, they've got a guard. I mean, they've got a guard. They almost won an NCAA tournament game where the other team scored on 17 consecutive possessions and they still almost won the game. And probably, I won't say should have won the game. But Florida fans will talk about the KJ Simpson play for the next decade. And rightly so. You know, they were up 10 at Alabama with 5 minutes to go, lost. You know, so I think you mentioned Vanderbilt, that cost them a seed line, fairly or unfairly. The committee remembered that and punished them for it. They've got to figure out how to win those games. Now, the one thing I will say that has been super important was holding serve at home last year. They were excellent at that. Other than the Kentucky slip up, they beat everybody in the O-Dome. I think that has to happen again because the schedule makers really didn't do Florida any favors. There's not a marquee game in the O'Connell Center other than the Virginia game in the ACC-SEC Challenge. Every other big-time basketball game for them almost is on the road. So to your point, how do you win a couple of those games? You guard. And I think that's why they built the roster the way they did.
Yep.
And took this gamble on a kid, Elijah Martin, who said, hey, look, the NBA scouts told me how I can play in the league because FAU listed me at 6'4 for a couple of years, and that's laughable, right, Riley? He's 6'2. So how do you play in the NBA as a 6'2 defensive stopper? Or you better figure out some sort of skill set that involves being able to handle the ball and pass. He's embraced that challenge, and now he has a chance to kind of lift all boats for that defense.
Well, Max, since you asked a variation of the last question I was going to ask, we're going to have a fun one here because I knew if we're going to have Neil on, you know, we're just coming off of a pretty remarkable feat in college basketball with the Connecticut Huskies winning back-to-back national championships.
Ooh.
So, Neil and Max, I'll let you get in on this because I know you're the expert betting guy. All right.
Oh, well,
We have to set a line, guys. The back-to-back Florida national champions versus the back-to-back UConn national champions. What are we starting the spread at for this game? And give me your reason why Florida would win this game handily. Because give me the Gators. We're leaning in on the SEC bias. But this is the SEC basketball experience. Give me the back-to-back Gators over the back-to-back Huskies.
Yeah, so I love this question. That's awesome. Putting me on the spot, I'd have Florida by 3.5. And the main reason is the reason that Florida beat Ohio State in the national title game to win their second national title. It's the waves of big men. It's the fact that, like, Donovan Klingon, that's great. Carabon, though, is not a guy who is going to be particular. He's not a guy who's going to bother an Al Horford on the interior. But Florida can send Chris Richard, who was the
who's in there banging around with Chris Richard at 6'9", 255, just completely moving people around. Like,
and like, he's an example of, you know, and there's a reason Danny Hurley talked to Billy Donovan about before last year about, like, how do I handle having guys who could be all league somewhere on my bench? And, you know, Billy, if you talk to Billy, he will rant about Chris Richard forever and say, like, in today's era, maybe he would have hit the transfer portal, but that never, like, Chris Richard never talked about transferring. It was just like, it's fine, I have a role to play. And he came in and he had 5 fouls and a warm body that also played in the NBA for a couple years. And Greg Oden, you know, said it was like, it was exhausting because they'd sit Joakim Noah and here came Chris Richard, you know? Yeah. So I think Florida's front court would be overwhelming. And then as good as, like, UConn's backcourt on the second national championship team was, like, it wasn't freakishly athletic, right? Like, nobody's like, you're not going to convince me that Cam Spencer was an elite athlete. Now, was he the best competitor in the NCAA last year other than Mark Sears? 100% he was. Like, you know, that's not a guy I want to run into in an alley, right? He's going to whip my ass. But, you know, Torian Green, Lee Humphrey, Corey Brewer, I feel like the backcourt's kind of a wash, so it becomes like a front court issue, and that's where Florida, I think, has an edge.
I think if you have the Adama Sanogo team, they would put up a better fight than this second team.
I think they beat Florida. I do.
The first one.
Yeah, I think the first one could beat Florida, but I don't think the last one could. You're really relying on – Stephen Castle, for example, to like have a big game. And Ohio State tried that. And Billy Donovan was like, hey, Mike Conley Jr., here's Corey Brewer again. And they played twice that year. And Florida won the first game by 30, I think, in Gainesville. And then the second game, Conley played a little better. But that was because Donovan put Brewer on Daquan Cook, who was going crazy in the NCAA tournament. And Daquan went like 1 for 10. Mm.
Max, you taking the Gators -3.5?
Versus the second team.
Yeah.
Multiple units.
Wow.
Like it. Like
Gamble it. Responsibly, folks. At BetOnline, by the way. But Max is taking multiple units here on this one. So.
Yeah.
All right. That works. All right. Well, Neil, if UConn wins another national championship, we'll have you back to debate that one. But maybe the Gators are moving closer to doing that because, as you said, a lot of momentum in the program right now.
They'd take a second weekend.
That's true. That may be the first step. Let's get there, and then we'll talk about back-to-back titles again. But, Neil, again, always a fun discussion. Always enjoy catching up with you. And let everybody know where they can find everything they need for the Florida Basketball Hour.
Sure. Yeah. Florida Basketball Hour is on Twitter at Florida BB Hour. Follow my guy, Eric Fawcett. I think one of the best analytical minds in basketball, really. And then I'm on Twitter too at NW Blackman. We're both coaches. So it's kind of a unique podcast in the sense that, like, there's not a lot of, I don't know how many podcasts are like, hey, two guys that have coached like high level high school basketball. And then Eric coaches professional basketball in Canada. So, it's a neat way to do it. And we talk a lot of SEC too. And Blake Lavelle is the godfather. He's still tied for the most appearances on our show. So we call him the godfather of SEC basketball. It's always good to spend some time with the godfather and Max.
The Godfather and Max. That maybe that's the new name of the show, Max.
I like that.
Like, SEC basketball experience pretty boring. Let's do the Godfather and Max. How about that?
You guys are awesome. Thanks for having me.
All right, so that was our discussion with Neil Blackman. Again, as you heard, Neil is fantastic in terms of just the knowledge on the Gators, and we'll see where things go here for Todd Golden Company entering his third season. A lot of high expectations for sure. But all right, Max, our favorite time of each week.
Trivia. Your favorite time.
Yeah, I always enjoy it. I got to catch up. That first week, Zam Frederick still haunts me in my dreams. But yeah, I got to get back on track here. So I'm going to let you ask the question first this week, and I will give you mine after.
Okay, you don't have to give me yours. It's okay if I just.
I got a lot brewing for you. So.
Good Lord. Okay, here we go. This is a very, very modern question as well. I like to keep it modern here.
Clearly.
So, who attempted the most three-pointers in the SEC last year? This is a two-parted question. I'll expand on this also. Who attempted the most threes? Not who made, just attempted.
I mean,
name to think about.
By default, you feel like you're gonna turn an Alabama player always, but I feel like that is evened out quite a bit based on how many different guys shoot the three. Reed Shepard sounds like a possibility. I mean, somebody from Florida, I assume. Gators weren't bad. I mean, they weren't bad, were they? I don't remember. It all runs together. Josh Hubbard may have actually attempted the most threes now that I think about it, because there were some games where he took, I want to say, 10 or more. Man, I feel like that's probably, you know, the more I think about it. Is this overall season or is this just an SEC play?
Overall season. Who attempted the most three-pointers last year?
I'm going Josh Hubbard. Now that I think about it, I'm like, there is no way anyone attempted more threes than him. Because the number of games we were like, hey, this guy just shot 18 threes or 13 or 15. Now that I think about it, I'm like, on the high scoring or the best three-point shooting teams, those numbers were spread out a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So you had, you know, guys that were attempting different. You didn't just have one guy taking that many. So Mississippi State, though, the three-point shooting, give me Josh Hubbard. I have no idea, but I'm going to assume because he had way more double-digit attempts than I can imagine anyone else had.
Yeah, so Josh, you're right. You're correct. Mm. Josh Hubbard attempted 304 threes last year.
Wow.
And right behind him at 302 was Wade Taylor.
Really?
Yes.
Wow, I didn't realize it was that close.
Yep. Only two
makes sense,
attempts.
But...
So this leads me to the second part of this question. So all time, this is the entire history of the SEC, only six players have attempted 300 or more threes in a season.
Wow.
Two of them are Josh Hubbard and Wade Taylor from last year. Who are the other four players? One of the other four players is the only one to do it multiple times. One of the other four did it twice.
Is Chris Lofton one of them?
Correct. You've got three others. And one
this
of the other
in the history of the SEC. Wow.
This, if you asked me this, I would have been lost.
All right. So Chris Lofton's one of them.
Yep.
That makes sense.
Three left.
Okay. I'm like, boy, this gets very, very difficult.
Yep.
Is John Jenkins at Vanderbilt one of them?
Correct.
Oh, look at that. Oh, yeah, we're rolling now. We got all the momentum. The train is just going down the tracks. All right, so John Jenkins, Chris Lofton.
Josh Hubbard and Wade Taylor, and then you got two players left, and one of the two did it in multiple seasons.
Can I have like an era? Can you give me like, is this,
yeah,
is this soon? Is this like 40 years ago? Is, I mean, it's not, but
I can tell you it's from, like, it doesn't go beyond 2010. It's the 2010s
okay.
into now for all these guys. One of the guys was an early 2010s, and then the other was a late 2010s. So they both weren't in the 2020s.
I should know this. I can see one of these guys, but I just cannot remember his name. Did one of them play for Florida?
No.
Did one of them play for Tennessee?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Lofton was the Tennessee one. Well, then I'm probably forgetting a Kentucky guy. And I'm like, no?
Do you want me to just tell you?
Is one of them... Oh, is Marshall Henderson one of them?
There you go.
Look at that.
He is actually the all-time leader in the SEC. He has the number one and number two spots. In 2012-2013, he attempted 394.
That's right. I was like, I knew I was forgetting an obvious one. I'm like, okay, Marshall Henderson makes sense. Yeah, okay.
And then the next year in 2013-14, he attempted 377.
I don't know why that one didn't come to me. I was like, I knew there was someone obvious, and I'm like, why am I not thinking of it? Okay, so there's only one guy left, right?
Okay, yeah. So ready for this? So Henderson has one and two. At 394 and 377.
Okay.
Chris Lofton is at 4, 307. John Jenkins, 305. Hubbard, 304. Wade Taylor, 302. You're missing a guy at number three who made 344 in the late 2010s.
All right. So we've already established, does it play for Tennessee, Kentucky, or Florida?
Good team, too. Good team. Really good team. Very good team, actually. Very, very good team.
Shane Foster?
Nope.
I knew Vanderbilt had a couple guys, but I wasn't sure if he'd be on there.
It was the 2018-2019 season. I'll give you another hint.
2018-19?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was thinking earlier. Okay, 18-19.
Yeah, late 2010s. A very good team.
The good teams in 18-19 were LSU, Kentucky, Tennessee, Auburn. Oh, it's got to be Bryce Brown.
Ding, ding, ding.
Okay, there we go. I was like, wait a second. Yeah, okay. That's there you go. One. All right, look at that.
Bryce Brown made 344. So there's your three-point shooter.
This is what we call a streak right here. Like, just rolling right along. Like, just rolling right along right now in terms of the answers here. I know I got a little hints on that one, but that was probably some Auburn fans screaming at their car right now. like, wait a second. Ole Miss fans, too. Like, how are you forgetting Marshall Henderson not high on the list? But, okay. All right. I feel a little bit better now. Like, we've come a long way from Zam Frederick.
That was a fun one.
We've come a long way. That was a good one. There's no way mine will be as good as that one. So, all right. I'm gonna do a player. I know we went a little long on that one, so I'm just going to give you a player. I was going to give you something else, but I'll give you a player. All right.
I won't get it right no matter what you give me.
I'm just going to, like, you should know this, but I'm going to say it because we have not talked about this guy in forever. And I was like, this was my guy when he was in the SEC. I was like, this guy is not getting enough love. Give this guy some love. Max, very simple. Who did Terrence Davis play for?
Ole Miss.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just talk about Terrence Davis, okay? Because I felt like he was someone who just, I mean, he was pretty solid. Like, and he, whoa. I feel like he never really got.
Was he
got
Kermit Davis?
He was there with Kermit Davis, but I want to say, I mean, he was there in 2016, so Andy Kennedy was still there. But, I mean, he was with Kennedy for most of his career, but then he was with Kermit for the, I think, was he there in Kermit's last season? Yeah, he was there in Kermit's last season. Or Davis was there during Davis's last season, which was Kermit's first season. So, yeah, like Terrence Davis, I think one of those guys that will probably go down as like one of your most underrated players in SEC basketball. I know the teams didn't necessarily reach the heights that they wanted to, but that guy was good. And then he went on to what? I mean, he started with the Raptors. I don't keep up with the NBA. I'm just going to be honest with you. So, like, I don't know where he's playing now. I think he's in Sacramento, or is he? I don't know where he's at, or that's maybe the last place he was at. But Terrence Davis, the Ole Miss Rebels. So there you go. All right.
I'm looking at his Terrence Davis in 2019 had some crazy games.
Oh, he did. He had some huge games. So I was trying to look up. So I know he got drafted, or he went undrafted. Then he wound up with the Raptors for a couple years, went to the Kings for a couple years. But now I think he's in the G League, or last played for Rip City Remix. So in the G League. So there you go. All right, but let's transition now, Max, to another weekly thing we've been doing these days as we get ready for the 24-25 season. Guess the starting lineup. And we're back to Big Blue Nation, to the Kentucky Wildcats for this edition of Guess the Starting Lineup. And boy, we got a lot of interesting options for this one. We've said like the past couple of weeks, we're like, we feel pretty confident about, I don't know who it was, Tennessee, Auburn, teams like that. But with Kentucky, good luck, because, man, there are a lot of interesting possibilities, of course, because Kentucky has a pretty much new-look roster, and you have a new coach, so there are a lot of intangibles here that, like, we just don't know how we, you know, maybe quantify exactly where to put, you know, these guys. But, Max, this should be an interesting exercise, maybe the most challenging one we've had so far, just based on how Mark Pope has put this roster together and seeing the different combinations that he has to play with here.
Yeah, and Mark Pope like doesn't really play with concrete positions.
Yeah, I was going to say, so he doesn't like adhere to the rules of like, you know, traditional basketball. So it's just, who knows who he's going to throw out there. So,
yeah. So we usually start with our locks, who we think we know is starting. And I only have two for you. I think, well, maybe three, but I think we've got to start with Jackson Robinson.
Yeah.
Jackson's got to be in there. I know he was sixth man of the year last year at BYU, but he played starter minutes. I mean, he was a starter basically without the tag of being a starter. I think he's going to be, you know, their what was everyone calling him? The bucket getter. We needed a bucket getter, right? Whatever you want to call it, Jackson Robinson. And then the other guy I have locked in, Lamont Butler. I don't know. You can't leave that guy off the court.
No, I agree. Those are locks. I don't know how they wouldn't be, just based on how the roster is constructed. And then, I mean, you know, that's where it gets interesting, because like we said, they do have Kirk Kreisev added to the mix. Kobe Brea, we talked about the shot-making ability of him. I think that's where, you know, what's the decision there? And also, I think it's not out of the – well, I'm curious what you think about this. Like, you know, if you really wanted to just – say, all right, what if we went Butler, Kreisa, Brea, Robinson, and like just like you said, sort of the position, let's just throw all these guys out there. We're going to score and score some more. And then you pick one of the big guys in the paint, whether that's Amari Williams or whoever. But yeah, like I think making that decision on if you're doing like your traditional two spot, if Butler is the one, and let's say Robinson's kind of your swing man who gets the buckets, you know, then it's like, okay, is it going to be Kreisa? Is it going to be Brea? I feel like it's pretty. Yeah. It, clear cut, it's one of those two guys. Like, I'd be shocked if it's not. So
who do we want to go for the sake of this segment? I personally have Kreisa just because of the accolades at Arizona, the big time games. He's been a starter for a while, but I could definitely see Brea being there.
Yeah, man. I think about what you can do when you have a guy like Bray on the floor and just how that, okay. Well, just for this exercise, we'll go with that. We'll go with Kreisa. Okay. So then it goes to the front court. So we've got, you know, the perimeter stuff figured out. Yep. So there, I mean, I feel pretty, I mean, it's Carr and Williams. Is it not?
So that's what I have. So we left out Otega Owe. When we were talking about the wing, I think he's going to be behind Jackson.
You could see him playing like a six man, right? Like being like a,
Yeah. So if you're looking at the traditional four spot, it would be probably Carr or Almanor. Now, just by logic, ACC starter against a non-power six starter, I'm going to go with Carr, but there's anyone who loves what Almanor brings to this team, it's me. So don't be surprised if he sneaks his hat in there for some quality minutes. Then we get to the Garrison Williams debate. I think that's the, you know, clearest. It's going to be one of these two guys, and it's pretty close. So I dove into it, Blake. I dove into it a little bit.
I'm excited.
Yep. Both of these guys played 18 conference games last year. Amari Williams in the CAA and Garrison in the Big 12. Both started all 18. Garrison played just under 26 minutes a game, and Williams just under 24. So right around the 25-minute mark for each guy. Amari Williams much more efficient, though. 13.2 points and 7.7 rebounds a game to Garrison's 8.8 points, 5.1 rebounds. So Big 12 to, you know, CAA is going to be a little bit different, especially for big men. But also Williams, 1.7 blocks per game to Garrison's one block. Now you have to take into consideration, this was Garrison's freshman year starting every game in conference play to Amari Williams' senior year, right? So for me right now, I went with Williams putting in that starting spot because this is his fifth year of college basketball. He put up the numbers last year. He's been consistent, but I think it's that like veteran consistent. We know what we're going to probably get from Williams to here's this young guy, loaded potential, who did get a good amount of playing time last year, but just wasn't as efficient as Amari Williams.
So if we go with that, like, I do think there is some intrigue, like I said a minute ago, with like, if you say Jackson Robinson could kind of slide into one of the front court spots, right? Like he could kind of play like a four type scenario. If you're doing just a traditional numbering or whatever.
Right.
Because he did that last year. If you look at their roster, right. Cause I'm looking here, like at BYU, they did the Hall, Johnson, Saunders, Robinson, and then Khalifa. Like that was kind of your lineup, which again kind of puts Robinson as the second tallest guy. So meaning, like that would make sense. But I'm curious if we were strong enough to say, all right, here's the one spot that changes. Is it Brea over Creasa, or is it one of the front court guys over another one of the front court guys?
I'm going to go with Brea over Creasa. I think they need that. I think they're going to need the size, but I think it's going to be matchup based. Like that's a fun thing that Mark Pope can do. He can go small and have four guys that can torch the Nets, or he can go bigger and have multiple guys taller than 6'10" on the court.
You know, I'm also, it's funny. We did this video, but like the more we talked about Ansley Almanor, like
I love him.
I think like he is someone too. Like you just look at it and I wonder how long, if let's say he's not from day one, if he's not, like, I wonder how long it takes, because we talked about just kind of the nature of his game and the production element. And like, again, you're talking about a guy who can step out and make shots, you know, and I mean, he's not as tall. Like it doesn't give you the 2-6-10 combo if you do the Williams car, but man, I don't know. I feel like he's the kind of guy, if you know, just for Mark Pope, I feel like Almanor may be the kind of guy that's just very hard to keep off the floor.
Yeah.
But again, that like we said, that's starter versus, okay, you can play more minutes than a starter even coming off the bench. So like it's, you know, it's not the way we used to look at things. But yeah, like this is a fascinating one, man. Like I don't know what to do, because this is a hard one to project, because you could see, you know, maybe three or more different combinations here based on, again, the guys he brought in, how they want to play, the three-point shooting element, needing some size. But, like you mentioned, there are a couple guys who feel like they're locks, and when you compare this one to the other teams we talked about, Kentucky certainly feels like they have more potential starting combinations than, quite honestly, maybe anybody in the SEC. Now that I look around and I'm like, pretty much everybody else feels pretty much like a lock in terms of who they're going to start. Maybe Vanderbilt's one that we just don't know, but there are at least some in there, though. I'm like, they've got to start. But Kentucky may be the biggest wild card. So
I don't make many guarantees, and usually when I do, they don't end up all that well for me. But but I'm making a guarantee right now. This man, Ansley Elmanor, is going to be on the court. I'm telling you right now, he's going to find a way. This guy's work ethic and his spacing, he's going to find a way on the court. But if I got to lock in a starting five right now, I'm going Kreese and Butler, kind of trading off the ball handling roles. Give me Jackson Robinson on the wing with Andrew Carr, that kind of stretch four big man role, and I'll go with Amari Williams.
I like it. All right, there you go. Kentucky fans weigh in. As always, we're not playing Nostradamus here. We're just we're just kind of giving you our thoughts and different combinations. So you guys let me know what you think. Yep. Hey, what do you want to see? Like, what lineup combinations are you most interested in? Let us know, as always, in the comments. But all right, Max, we're going to wrap up with our predictions. As always, we wrap up with our one bowl prediction from each of us. And as I said, I'm feeling a little bit better about one of those predictions, Max. Elijah Martin, All-SEC. Our guy Neil Blackman got me all pumped up about that one. Yep. So I don't know if this one will go as well, but we'll find out. All right, Max, one bold prediction. As always, some of these are more bold than others, but let's see what you got.
Yep. Last week I went with a not so bold one. I said Auburn will be undefeated at home. It's hard, but I want to go bolder. This week I'm going to go freshman. I'm going young. And I'm going multiple Texas freshmen will make the SEC all-freshman team. Multiple. Now, that means Trey Johnson, right, the highest-rated freshman coming into the SEC, cannot wait to watch Trey Johnson. But I'm talking Nick Cody, all right? Now, when you look at some of the freshmen last year that surprised, Josh Hubbard comes to mind right away. Not rated highly, but the team needed him no matter what. He could have been rated, unranked, whatever. They needed his skill set. So he was going to be on the court. And when I look at this Texas front court, taking nothing away from Jason Kent, I really do like his game from Indiana State. He plays very fundamental, great shooter. And then you have Caden Shedrick also. But underneath that, you have two freshmen. You got Nick Cody and you got Jamie Vincent. Now, I'm a little bit higher on Cody than Vincent, but hey, Mr. Vincent, if you want to have yourself a year and make me look like a genius here, go by all means, Mr. Vincent, go for it. But Nick Cody, now this is a 6'9 guy who was 6'7 not too long ago. He's really on a tear, and he's flying up the rankings. This guy is, I think he's into the top 50, top 40 composite freshman rankings. He's 6'9". Watch this guy's highlights. He can put his back to the basket and post up and have a little bit of a low post game. But this guy shoots 40% from three also in the Adidas circuit right now. Like, has a nice looking shot, smooth shot, can block shots. I'm telling you right now, Nick Cody and Vincent are going to have to play. Kent and Shedrick can't play 40 minutes a game each. And so, you know what? If we're doing some bold predictions, Give me one of those guys to have a great year, and give me multiple Texas guys on the all freshman team.
All right, well, so I don't know if technically this is bold. There will be some people who may see it as bold. This particular fan base for this player may not see it as bold. Okay. But I'm going here, Max. So yesterday I sent you a tweet that was tweeted out by Jordan Moore, who covers Tennessee on the Fox Sports Knoxville network there. And I'm going to read you this tweet. I'm sure we could have pulled it up and made it look better, but I'm just going to read it to you instead.
Yeah, yeah.
From Jordan Moore. Here's the tweet. Coach Barnes has his players participate in a shooting drill called the KD drill, where a player has to make 9 out of 10 shots from 7 different locations on the floor. If a player doesn't make 9 out of 10, they start the drill over. Only one player has been able to complete the drill under Barnes, Kevin Durant, hence the drill's nickname. Tennessee's portal edition, Chaz Lanier, completed it on his second try. Therefore, Max Barr, one bold prediction. Chaz Lanier, just like a former Tennessee player, now a Los Angeles Laker. Dalton Knecht did last season. Tennessee will go back-to-back, having the leading scorer in the SEC, your leading scorer in the SEC in 24-25, Chaz Lanier.
Wow. Jazzy Chaz.
I feel like I need to go a little bit more bold. I feel like some might have not been that bold. So I'm like, I'm going to go in this one, though. I don't know if it's that bold now that we see this. I mean, this guy is he's a walking bucket. So averaged 19.7 points per game last year. He's stepping into the Dalton Knecht role. I'm all in on the hype. Give me Chaz Lanier as the leading scorer. And if people want to say, well, why wouldn't you pick Sears, Broom? Because I think the numbers will even out for those teams. But I think Lanier, as we said, he's got to be the guy on this team. And so give me Chaz Lanier, leading scorer in the SEC.
I was just going to say, and when you look at this Tennessee roster, how it's shaken out, you have what seems to be a more defensive-minded take at the center spot, bringing in Akpara. We do have some offense with Milicic and Dubar at the four, but we don't know exactly how that's going to shake out. Most likely Jemai Meshack as your defensive specialist, and Zakai Ziegler doing a little bit of everything, but has never really been fully himself when he's asked to be the main scorer. So that leaves none other than Chaz Lanier.
We'll see. A lot of bold predictions out there. We'll see which ones come through. We're only five episodes in. We got many more. I was like, we got to get some of these right. That's why we're making all these predictions. It'll be really fun to look back after the season and say, wow. If any of us go over, do you think there's a chance that either of us go over for the entire season? We're going to do this once a week for the next, how many weeks? Is there a chance that one of us just go with a complete goose egg? Possible.
I wouldn't put it out of the realm of possibilities.
We'll find out. All right, guys. There you go. Episode number 5 in the books, the SEC basketball experience. We hope you enjoyed it. As always, hit the subscribe button, hit the like button. If you're listening on the podcast, do the same thing. You can find us on any podcast app you listen to if you want to listen or if you want to watch. Of course, we're on YouTube, as always there. Check out all of our other stuff, SEC football, SEC baseball as well. We've got it all here at Southeastern 14 / soon to be Southeastern 16. And so be sure to subscribe button. Hit the like button on your way out. And thanks, as always, for watching the SEC basketball experience. Remember, you can always support the show by checking out those products you see below. We've got a variety of products you can buy from these different vendors, and all it does is give us a little kickback, nothing extra on your part. You can also reach out to caroline.smith@southeastern14.com if you want to sponsor the show. We're always looking for sponsors here. So, again, we appreciate you guys watching, and we'll talk to you again here soon at Southeastern 14.